from KQED Public Radio. This is a unusual Capital Notes podcast, is it not?
They're all unusual. This one's just strange.
We are sitting here like, what, Ebert and Siskel and Ebert used to?
I'm thinking more of the two guys at the Muppet Show. You
the
know?
Two old curmudgeons. I'm John Myers from KQED. That's Anthony York from Capital Weekly and the LA Times. And this is the big Capital Weekly election post-mortem that we're sitting in the Crest Theater in Sacramento.
Right. And our work is done here. Right?
Is it?
Is it? Yeah, I think so. We're spectators now.
Well, so this is going to be an unusual event because we're actually on this podcast. We're going to let you hear some of the featured luncheon conversation between Jim Brulte, former state Senate, state assembly leader for Republicans, and Susan Kennedy, the current chief of staff for Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger. So a little bit of their analysis of probably the governor's race is a big thing we want to talk about. But I figured I would corral Anthony here for a moment to do 5 minutes of our own take, since people have actually emailed me, Anthony. Asking what we were going to talk about.
Did something happen this week? I was unaware.
So let's talk about Brown Whitman. I mean, the polls were right. Jerry Brown trounced her, yeah. At least at the numbers so far.
Well, and now the hard part. I mean, I think it was pretty clear for weeks that the wheels were sort of falling off the Whitman campaign, and not only the Whitman campaign, but Barbara Boxer getting reelected, and it looks like perhaps a clean sweep. For Democrats in statewide offices. And then, now we've got a new governor and larger majorities in the legislature, as we've talked about on this podcast before, and a new set of rules governing how state budgets work, and a big unknown.
Well, we can talk more about the governor's race perhaps another time. Maybe we'll get Juliet or somebody to come back and talk about people who've covered the race, but all of that last-minute chatter from the Whitman campaign that, oh, the surge is coming, I mean, that's feels like spin.
Well, and it feels like 2005, I mean, when another campaign headed by Mike Murphy.
Arnold Schwarzenegger's special election disaster.
Who was also, you know, the chief strategist for what was her name again? Meg Whitman, this time around. But remember, the weekend before the campaign, there was a press briefing indicating that that the special election measures were all they were all going to pass, maybe all but one, and they all got creamed. And so it was all spin. As it turned out, Whitman was rejected, as was the California Republican Party up and down the state.
Feels like, I mean, tell me your thoughts quickly here, but I mean, you know, one of the things I keep coming back to is it was a bit of a death by a thousand cuts for the Whitman campaign. She never seemed to connect with the voters at the beginning. She never established herself as, I guess, as a qualified candidate, a legitimate candidate, and then she never had a base then on which to deal with the stuff that happened. I mean, the housekeeper saga, everything else. It was never, the foundation didn't seem right in some ways.
Well, and we've talked about her inability to connect with voters. Sort of a lack of empathy and a very corporate approach to this campaign. I think that ultimately hurt her. And a lack of consistency about messaging. I mean, her messaging was all over the place. I mean, it was jobs, 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 but there were commercials and mailers on every, it was a cacophony of messaging that I think ultimately hurt her in the end.
Do you have any sense of what you think are blunders? I mean, I hate to say it that way, but that you look back to? One to me is that you didn't get the housekeeper thing out earlier, but also there's the trying to portray Brown as a big tax and spender, which his record as governor wasn't even that. I mean, what do you...
Right. I think those two things are pivotal. And never sort of making the case for herself, you know. I mean, it was jobs. It was sort of a... she came in at 20,000 feet, and I think sort of a little more building from the bottom up may have helped her, you know, as she... But we got commitments from the Brown and Whitman campaign to come join us on our podcast during that third debate. Maybe we should bring them in next week to have.
I have actually had that conversation, the cocktails podcast with two of the big spokespeople. So we'll see if that happens. What do you think quickly about Brown? I mean, I almost feel like it's you know, I don't want to disrespect the work their campaign did, but there was a lot of picking the least disagreeable choice by voters, it seems like, in some ways. No, I mean, they had concerns about Brown.
Well, and Brown's going to have some challenges. I mean, you know, as some of our panelists today have pointed out, Brown was running for other offices last time he was governor. He ran for president twice and U.S. Senate once. That's 6 of the 8 years that he was governor, was spent busy running for something else. Now, if we are, you know, hey, if any 76-year-old is going to run against a, or 74-year-old would run against an incumbent president of their own party, it would be Jerry Brown. But barring that, this is going to be Brown as a governor in the classical sense of a governor. And we'll see how he focuses and how, if he's able to roll up his sleeve and his sleeves and get something done.
What do you think? What do you think about this idea that he could only serve one term? More people are talking about it. I asked him that in Oakland on Wednesday, and I thought he bristled a little bit, but then he said, "Well, I've opined with people about it," which was a way of redefining the you know what he has said to people. But what do you make of that?
Well, I mean that's fine. I mean, but what difference would that make? I mean, does that
mean pro or con?
Right. I mean, does that mean that he's immediately a lame duck and that people can wait him out? Or that there are a lot of reforms that people in their hearts know need to happen that they'll be able to pawn off on him. But that would still hurt the Democrats. I mean, so I'm not sure that makes much of a difference. Do I think it's possible? Yeah. But whether or not it makes a difference, I'm not sure.
And were you surprised, last thing, and then we'll wrap this up. You can go back to your big party here.
Yeah.
Were you surprised anything on Election Day? Anything surprised you out of other than the painfully slow rate of getting returns from the Secretary of State's website?
That's another podcast. The Attorney General's race surprised me, Kamala Harris. You know, there was that last field poll before the election that indicated it was a close race, and it turned out to be right. She may actually pull this off. And some of the ballot initiatives, and we should maybe talk about that next week, and they've been a subject of this sort of post-mortem conference, which you can see on the Cal Channel.
Oh, there's a plug, calchannel.com.
But the passage of both Proposition 25 and 26 is sort of at first blush, perhaps some schizophrenic messaging from the voters of California, and one that caught me off guard.
And I have to say, the one that actually surprised me a little bit was Prop 21, which was the fact that, you know, for $18 a year, the voters were not willing to spend the money to get into state parks. I'm not saying that people want to spend more money, but $18 compared to some of the things I spend, I'm not saying I'm advocating for that measure. Right. But that measure seemed, you know, parks usually win on the ballot. That was a bit of a surprise to me.
Right. But it seemed voters are tired of being nickel and dimed. I mean, that's the message. So, you know, how these results are interpreted and what lawmakers decide to do with it and what the new governor decides to do with it, I think will be the subject of podcasts to come.
And that was me and Anthony York speaking in the middle of this post-election event sponsored by Capital Weekly and the UC Center of Sacramento. And now I'm at a different place. So as I said, it's an unusual podcast this week. I'm actually down in San Luis Obispo right now at an event, again talking about the election, but again trying to cobble together the podcast for you this week to let you hear some of what happened at that event on Thursday, which really had a lot of interesting folks talking about politics. Up next, I want to play a segment here from Tony Quinn, a well-known political analyst, co-editor of the Target book, which looks at races all across California, and some of Tony's comments not only about Jerry Brown and the legacy of Brown and the history of the Brown family, but also a little bit about what happened with Republicans in this election.
We have been electing people to state office named Edmund G. Brown since 1946. The first election of Governor Brown 52 years ago. That was 1958. In fact, by my research, there's no family in the world that has been more politically successful than the Brown family, except that of Kim Il-sung in North Korea. So a couple of other interesting things. I just want to mention a number of years, election years. 1912, 1920, 1932, 1946, 1948, 1958, 1974, 1966, 1994. All these years were landslide years for the incumbent party, especially 66 and 94 for the Reaps. Every year, the landslide, no matter what it was, came right to the shores, right through this state. This year, it did not. What is amazing to me is how bad the Republicans did in California and how good they did everywhere else. They will have gained probably about 64, 65 seats in the U.S. House. The last time that they gained that many seats was 1938. The last time any party gained that many seats was 1948. So this is the largest shift in the U.S. House in 70 years. If you want to know what really happened in California, the B today has the exit poll. And this is a very good exit poll, and it tells two really important things. Number one, the ethnic turnout. The ethnic turnout in this election for Latinos were 22% of the of voters who voted. That is the largest number ever. They were 18% in the big Obama landslide of 2 years ago. 4 years ago, they were 12%.
That, again, was Tony Quinn, co-editor of the Target Book and a well-known political analyst in California. And then, of course, Jerry Brown's biggest challenges are going to be running the state and how he does that as governor, especially in a Democratic state with a Democratic legislature. One of the other speakers at this event on Thursday was Gary South, who was the top political advisor to former Governor Gray Davis. And Gary, as you might imagine, had a few things to say about how Davis fared in the Capitol with his fellow Democrats. Here's what Gary had to say.
Having had a ringside seat during the governorship of the last Democratic governor of this state, we know how that ended. I think there are several factors that we're going to have to be looking at over the next 4 years with respect to the relationship between the new Democratic governor and the Democratic legislature. You know, Jerry Brown during the campaign was fond of saying that he knew where all the bodies were buried. He had all this institutional memory. But the fact is, it's not a criticism, it's just a fact. There's nothing about this legislature that is really the same as it was when Jerry Brown was governor the first time. There were no term limits during the first Jerry Brown administration. There were no contribution limits during the first Jerry Brown administration. And as a result, the leadership, as we know, in both the Senate and the Assembly, during the time when we did not have contribution limits, most of the money was collected by the leadership PACs of the President Pro Tem and the Speaker and doled out to the members of their caucuses or in open seats where they wanted to, you know, protect a seat or take over a seat. That clearly doesn't exist anymore. What we've done with Prop 34, which was passed, as you know, by the voters in 2000, and came into effect in legislative races in 2002 and then in statewide races in 2006, what we've done is really we're starving the candidates to death, and we've really shifted the balance of power in legislative races and in the functioning of the legislature to the special interests who have money to burn and axes to grind.
That was Gary South, who was the top political advisor to former Governor Gray Davis, Democratic political consultant, talking about a few of the challenges that Jerry Brown might have, not only with Republicans and the rest of the process, but also with his fellow Democrats at the state capitol. And the two main speakers at this post-election event on Thursday in Sacramento really were a couple of people who know a lot about what happens under the Capitol Dome and what's going to face the new governor, the new legislature, and also what to make of this election. And they were Jim Brulte and Susan Kennedy. Jim Brulte, as you might know, was the longtime leader in both the Assembly and Senate of the Republicans in the 1990s and the early 2000s before being termed out of office. Brulte, well known as one of the most insightful Republicans about politics in California. And Susan Kennedy, who is Arnold Schwarzenegger's chief of staff, who's a Democrat, who's been his chief of staff for the last 5 years, and who was a deputy chief of staff to former Governor Gray Davis. So they're having a conversation in this lengthy excerpt you're going to hear it here with A.G. Block, former editor of the California Journal, now heads up part of the UC Center at Sacramento, and he was the moderator for this discussion between Brulte and Kennedy. And their conversation ranges not only from what Jerry Brown can expect, to also about the results of this election, what we should make of those results, what the voters might have been saying, and again, what lies in store next year at the state capitol. So here in conversation with moderator A.G. Block are Susan Kennedy, chief of staff to Arnold Schwarzenegger, and longtime Republican politician Jim Brulte, and Brulte begins.
Governor-elect Brown's going to have some pleasant surprises and some unpleasant surprises. First of all, Governor Brown is the last governor to be successfully overridden. But when Governor Brown was in office back when I was in college and Susan was in elementary school, he was dealing with people who had been around a long time, who were legislative giants on both sides, and really knew how to interact with an administration. And from time to time, the legislature handed Governor Brown his bottom. I think he's going to be surprised by the quality of the members of the legislature. It's a fundamentally different legislature today. It is an increasingly polarized legislature. When I ran for office in 1990, about 50% of the voters were Democrat, about 39% were Republican, less than 10% were declined to state voters who are pure swing independents. We've seen a decline in the party registration. Republicans are now below 31% or hovering at it. Democrats dropped to 42% before they popped back up to 44 because of the Obama-Clinton primary battle, which generated registration, but they're on their way back down now. And decline to states, pure independents, have jumped from a little under 10 to over 20 today. And who are the independents? They're basically moderate Republicans and moderate Democrats that don't agree on anything except that they dislike both political parties. So Governor Brown is going to find a legislature that is geometrically more partisan today than the legislature that existed even a decade and a half ago. There is no reward for bipartisan cooperation. In fact, there's a punishment for bipartisan cooperation. Just ask the two Republican leaders who were removed for supporting tax increases. Ask Anthony Adams, who was the subject of a recall, which would have succeeded had they not gathered signatures in my town, which is outside of his district, and inside of his district. And just ask Roger Nilo, very popular legislator who just lost a special to Ted Gaines. So the first unpleasant surprise he's going to find is the legislature is geometrically more partisan. The second unpleasant surprise he's going to find is that as a result of that partisanship, as a result of Prop 34, which inhibits the ability of rank-and-file citizens to contribute, as a result of term limits, which doesn't allow people around long enough to establish credibilities with core constituencies, he's going to find a legislature that is much less interested in what a governor thinks and much more interested in what the special interests think. Prop 34, let's just go some numbers real quick. If you find 100 people in your district to max out to you, that's $390,000. Well, that sounds like a lot of money, but SEIU, CTA, the California Dental Association, the CMA, they can all spend north of $1 million beating you up and ending your career. When I first got here, you really cared about what governors thought if you were a legislator because they could make your political life miserable. Much less so today. The special interests have geometrically more authority. So he's going to be unpleasantly surprised about that.
So his short answer, his experience really isn't going to translate.
It's a different world.
Yeah. Susan?
I think his experience being mayor of Oakland is going to serve him better than any experience he had when he was governor. Sorry. I said I think his experience as mayor of Oakland is going to be more helpful to him and impactful than any experience he had as governor, because I think it's a completely different place in Sacramento for a slightly different reason than what Jim said. I think term limits and redistricting, the combination of those two things, has dramatically changed Sacramento, and it's created a system of weak leaders that are, you know, constantly changing. So you don't have the history, you don't have the relationships, you don't have the forward-looking. I mean, everyone's looking at the next 2 years or four-year increments. They're not looking at building the state or doing something that's going to come to fruition years after you leave office. So you have a very weak leader system in the legislature right now. You have very hyper-partisan districts, and the combination of these things has allowed the interest groups on the left and the right to own and operate the legislative process. We're in a situation now where even when you agree on an issue, the legislative leaders cannot necessarily get the votes if the interest groups that are backing their particular party disagree. They literally are the legislators are more afraid of what the interest groups can do to them in the next primary than they are what the leader can do to them. Getting their office taken away or their committee chairmanship taken away is nothing compared to being facing a well-funded opponent or losing an endorsement in the next race. So what that does to a governor, especially a governor of the same party as the dominant majority, is it's going to be, I think, very frustrating for him to come in and try to enact a legislative agenda where that doesn't got to kind of go with the flow of where things would normally go. If he's going to try and veer off in any way, he's going to hit those walls, and he's not going to have the leadership structure or the support in the legislature to buck those trends, and that's going to be very frustrating for him.
The as you pointed out in your opening remark, the electorate now, both here in California and especially nationwide, for two consecutive elections has expressed a lot of frustration and an expectation that because one group or another group was thrown out, that suddenly there's going to be this epiphany and everyone is going to do what the electorate would really like, which is bipartisan cooperation to try and solve problems. And that will lead to a certain level of expectation. You could say that Prop 25, even if it was the I'm going to cut your pay, it has raised the expectation that now it's going to be easier to pass a budget. That's been thrown in the Democrats' lap. Does it make it easier for them to do that, Susan?
Well, I mean, I think you asked two different things here. The first thing is, what are the voters saying? I mean, people tend to terribly misread the electorate. They think that it's extremely nuanced. I think they're very intelligent and they do discern. There's no, I totally agree with you on that. But we always try to look in the mirror and say, oh, ha, this is what they meant to say. They really want our agenda. The voters are frustrated. What happened in the, I don't think they voted conservatively. I disagree with you slightly on the way you said that. They basically, the Republican candidates were not credible. The top of the ticket Republican candidates were not credible to them. And Meg Whitman, I think, brought down the rest of the ticket. It had no coattails and brought down the rest of the ticket. And Jerry Brown actually had coattails on this. And so I think there was a sense of frustration that translated into what was basically a Democratic sweep of all the statewide offices. At the same time, the message they're sending to these new leaders is just get it done, just get the job done. The budget has come to symbolize the dysfunction in the state. Conflated with the unemployment rate, it's just become the symbol of what's wrong with California, or that we're so off on a wrong track. And the voters just said, get it done, do it without new taxes, do it without Republicans, do it without stealing local dollars, just get it done. And the Democrats are like the dog that caught the car. I don't think it's going to make it any easier for them at all. I mean, it doesn't matter if the budget is 100 days. I mean, if the budget's 100 days late, it hurts us with the financial markets. It hurts us. They talk, if we go to IOUs, they equate California with Greece. I mean, these are image issues. These are, you know, it's bad for us to have this image. But it's not going to make us our image any better if the budget is on time, but it's a bad budget.
And so the expectations that may be raised by some of the results in this election, you think will be frustrated once again, and
you know until the unemployment rate is not 12.5%, I think the expectations are going to be dashed constantly. I mean people are hurting. They're frightened. They're just going through a situation where they're losing their homes. They still haven't figured out how they're going to survive economically. And the politicians in Sacramento are throwing food at each other. So it's like unless and until the economy improves and the job climate improves and they see people working together to get something done, you're going to have a frustrated electorate.
That again was Susan Kennedy, Arnold Schwarzenegger's chief of staff, former deputy chief of staff to Governor Gray Davis, and Jim Brulte, ex-assembly member and state senator, Republican from Rancho Cucamonga, and the moderator of that portion of this event in Sacramento was A.G. Block, former editor of the California Journal. And so an unusual podcast for this week, but just a little sampling of what people are talking about.